From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's the top of the week, which means it's time for some more strange news. We have a cavalcade of weird stuff, and I think off air, we tried to have at least one semi-optimistic story that off air we decided to save for the end. And full confession, fellow conspiracy realists, Matt, Noel, Doc, I'm cheating just a little bit with my story today because it's an opportunity to talk about one of my favorite kinds of animals in the world. Octopuses, you're thinking? No, but close.
And also, badgers?
Yeah. Badgers, you're thinking? No, but close. Yeah, arguably closer, really.
It's definitely ferrets. Yeah, ferrets? No?
Oh, gosh. Well, now I feel like we should just do an animal show because those are all great suggestions. But today I wanted to talk a little bit about corvids, about crows. These amazing creatures have often been lauded more and more of late for their intelligence, which for a long time did not make sense to ornithologists, scientists, well, maybe Scientologists too, and neuroscientists around the world, because crows have a very, very small brain, but they do things that ordinarily we only think of other animals being capable of doing, namely mammals. So crows can teach their young and the other members of their murder across generations to remember the faces of those who have wronged them and the faces of those who have helped them. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy stuff.
And just to be clear, they aren't teaching murder. They teach the other crows around them.
They do also teach murder, as we come to find.
Yeah. No way.
Yes way, Ted. So what's happening here is that scientists may have finally figured out why crows, which have such a small brain comparatively, are so incredibly intelligent, why they can do things that humans and elephants and some octopuses, again, that is the correct plural. Well, octopi is acceptable too, but whatever. Not a hill to die on. They found out why these birds can think at such a high level. We found out recently, through some research unveiled earlier this month in September, that crows are capable of metacognition. This is like a holy grail of philosophy. Metacognition is just the fancy word for being able to think about thinking. So when you are having your Rene Descartes moment and you say, I think, therefore I am, and you're thinking about your thinking, it turns out these birds can do that too. Why? How? They shouldn't be able to. At least that was our thought. Now we can explain it because it seems that based on two papers that were recently released, it seems that crows have a very high density of neurons in their very small brains. So it's like, imagine how something like popcorn or celery has maybe relatively low caloric content, and the same amount of peanut butter would have more caloric content.
Mm-hmm.
Their brains are peanut butter.
That sounds like an insult, but I know what you mean by that. Yeah, it's like the Noom app. I don't know if this isn't a sponsorship, but they help you lose weight by pushing the less calorically dense things. Like, you can eat like your weight in lettuce and it's like 2 calories. But if you eat just that, you know, tablespoon of peanut butter or mayo, it's like, you know, the equivalent of eating a whole bag of cabbage or something like that. Very interesting, Ben. So what does this mean for like the way they behave, or at least what scientists understand about the intention maybe behind the way they behave?
Yeah, yeah, great question. So a crow's brain has about 1.5 billion neurons. This puts them, as members of the TV show Community would say, streets ahead in comparison to other avians. They did a test where, like, how do you prove something so deep as the concept of crows thinking about thinking, right? Do you just smoke a lot of weed till you convince yourself that's not a crazy question?
Yeah.
Or do you, right? Or maybe they do, but then they do some science. So they wanted to test whether crows can both be aware of and analyze the contents of their literal bird brains. A neurobiologist named Andreas Nider from the University of Tübingen in Germany trained two crows to peck at a red or a blue target on a panel, depending on whether they saw a faint light. And this neurobiologist kept varying the rules of the game. So the crows would be told which color meant what after the flash. Like, they would see a flash, and sometimes they would have to peck the red target to acknowledge they had seen it. But then other times they have to peck the blue target. That's important because it means the crows have to take a second or two to figure out what they had seen earlier and then exhibit that behavior to the neurobiologist. And while they were doing this, they're tracking these crows' neurological activity, and they found that sensory neurons were active when a crow saw the flash, and these neurons indicated the crow's brain basically saying, yeah, I saw that. And if they did not see this flash, those sensory neurons were silent, and the crow would say, peck, no, I didn't see anything. And this means that the birds are aware of what they subjectively perceive, and they're correctly reporting what their neurons will tell them. That sounds a bit in the weeds. I get it. There's a little bit of jargon, but the main takeaway is this. They have behavioral flexibility. That's probably one of the best definitions of intelligence that our species has. We have mostly terrible definitions of intelligence. And this means crows are able to do something that only two other animals can do. Human beings and macaw monkeys. I know that last one's kind of a plot twist, but now it's the three of us. I'm mainly using this story, by the way. It is amazing science, but I'm mainly using this to tell you about the other interesting thing I learned, you guys, about crow intelligence. Crows are in an unending war with certain types of owls.
Okay, what?
Wait, does it go back generations to some, you know, period where an owl wronged a crow and they've just generationally, you know, carried on this beef of like a Hatfield and McCoy type situation? Or is it something biological? This is incredible.
It seems to be both genetically imprinted. You can take a crow raised in captivity and it'll have never encountered an owl and it'll just freak out. Smash on sight. And owls are the same way, especially the great horned owl. Owls are like, okay, so I was thinking of a good analogy here. So picture crows and owls in their unending existential war. Crows are kind of like the humans, and owls are kind of like the vampires or the monsters that go bump in the night. Owls are unparalleled nocturnal predators in the world of crows. And owls are a lot like great horned owls, especially, are a lot like serial killers when it comes to crows. If they find a roost of crows, then they will kill them even if they don't need to eat anything. There's one great report from Cape and Islands that shows a great horned owl had basically done a breaking and entering operation on a roost of 9 crows. And their bodies were untouched except for their heads, which were partially removed, and their brains were eaten. And
oh, it my left God. Them.
Yeah.
Wow, dude. Sick. Amazing. It reminds me of the time when I lived in Athens that a bunch of frat boys stole a great horned owl from the outdoor zoo. Wait, it's nothing like that at all. But
did owls it eat are, them?
It's unclear. But did you hear about owls? There was a story I heard on NPR a couple of years ago about a woman who was walking late at night and something kind of swooped down and like then she felt blood running down her face. And apparently it was an owl that can they can fly soundlessly in the night. And they she must have mistook or the owl must have mistook this woman's hair for like a vole or some small, you know, delicious rodent. I don't know that we have an epidemic of owls attacking humans or corvids attacking humans, because that would be my hell on earth, by the way. Just putting that out there.
Yeah. Owls also are capable of successfully predating on cats. Like they can snatch up grown cats. I think they're one of the things owls can't swallow whole. But when we think of this, we know that because of their intelligence then, crows are, in some cases, functioning like vampire hunters. They're saying, they have to attack en masse, right? They have to attack in numbers and do what's called mobbing the owl. And so they'll assemble like a crew of corvids and say, you know, we have to attack at dawn when the monster is vulnerable because it owns the night. And given their intergenerational learning, given their great intelligence, given their communicative ability, the coolest thing about this, at least to me, is this means that somewhere out there right now, there's like a crow version of Van Helsing and it's hunting, it's hunting a great horned owl Dracula that is just out to kill crows.
Yeah, okay. I would read that comic. One of the most interesting things here when you're talking about the corvid response to the owl threat is that mobbing behavior, I guess. They're on that same Cape and Islands article you were mentioning there, Ben, it's speaking about how this person who's writing it, the author, has seen a barn owl that got flushed out just from where it would normally be staying in daylight hours. Mm-hmm. And like a vampire caught out in the daylight, not like that because he would just dissolve into ash, but some corvids saw it and they did the mobbing thing and they ended up, they essentially attacked it until it had to escape and it jumped over a cliff, I guess, and went down into the water, into the ocean rather than being able to fly or anything. It was really kind of sad for the owl.
Rather than be taken alive by the gang of corvids that were after it?
Well, I don't know. I guess, I mean, it was just an attempt to escape, I suppose. But
they drove it into the sea.
Yeah.
That is cold-blooded. You guys remember that movie, The Secret of Nim? The really dark cartoon movie from the late 80s, I guess? There was Jeremy the Crow, who is kind of a goofy, fun character. But then there was the Great Owl, which if I've ever seen a depiction of an owl in vampiric kind of like tones, that's it. That is one of the creepiest. It wasn't even a villain. It actually ended up giving some good info. But I believe Jeremy refused to go in because of a fear or bias against owls. I may be making that up, but that would be cool if they did think about that biology in the character development.
So it's one thing that's amazing here is the more we learn about intelligence, the more we learn that it is nowhere near unique to humans. And even like think about how familiar these animals are. Everybody listening to today's show has probably seen a crow, right? They're ubiquitous in many parts of the world, but their intelligence itself is still so alien, not as alien as that of an octopus, but I feel like the more we learn about these things, the more we're going to learn about their cognitive abilities. They hunt serial killers. I mean, to them, these owls are serial killers, if you think about it. So this is just a kind of a hobby horse. Matt, you probably remember back in the Buckhead days, there were a couple of crows in the nearby Buckhead Mall. And I would try to go talk to them in the parking lot. They didn't care, by the way. I want a murder of crows that I can befriend. And I know people have done it. I don't know, man. City crows are stuck up.
You communed with the crow both at the old Buckhead office, like you're saying, and also I think one trip to LA, I saw you out on the porch talking to a corvid, or at least, engaging with it in some way. You've always been fascinated by these creatures.
But they're so smart.
Just to put this out there for a little bit of context for everybody, the one that we call Ben, the one that goes by Ben, he, back in that day, around that time when we were in that office, Ben had a specific outfit that he would wear. And I noticed this, Ben, it wasn't lost on me. There was a specific outfit that was very crow-like that I would sometimes see you wear when I would happen to glance you venturing out to speak with the Corvids. I saw what you were doing.
You got me. Because like we could, the four of us now, Doc, you, Matt, you, Noel, and myself, we could go out and if we treated a population of crows very well and we came back and we were wearing the same clothes and we didn't make a bunch of changes to our facial hair or our haircuts, then the crows would remember and then they would start giving us weird crow stuff. Like,
yeah,
we talked about this earlier today, Noel. Actually, they'll give you what they think of as human stuff, but if you wrong them,
right,
their children will remember.
But do you think they tell their buddies about you? They, hey, this guy's okay. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, like there's Corvids like nesting in telephone poles as you're taking your walk down the street, you know, like waiting on you to do their bidding. I want to see you like Night King style, raise your arms up and then like the Corvids just come flocking towards you and like a cloud of black, you know, crows surrounding Ben. I mean, it's terrifying. I'm not going to lie, but that I would never
make you sit through that, man. I'm actually your friend. So
I appreciate that, but yeah. I do.
But this,
I would get popcorn if that happened.
Yeah. Just, they love popcorn.
They would come for your pop. They would come for your corn. They'd come for your corn.
I would offer it as a sacrifice to the Crow King.
You can, the last thing about crow intelligence and cooperation in the wild is, it goes even further than we think. We don't know the full extent. If you are a hunter, and crows are, as you guys said, familiar with you, you've been in these woods before, and you've left some kind of offering to them while you're hunting, they will help you find animals to hunt. Like, they will fly up, and they're not trained to do this. They'll teach themselves to point out the deer or the elk or what have you to the hunter, and they do it because they know that when the hunter kills that animal, it'll leave something for them. It's very, very strange. Anyway, let us know your Corvid adventures. Please do not wrong them. And please remember, they are wild animals. They're just very, very intelligent. We don't know how smart they are yet. But this, I can't wait. I hope somebody has a pet crow.
you said the word familiar, you know, and it made me think of like, you know, you see crows often as a witch or warlock familiars. That's the term they use. And I think that's really appropriate. Did anybody in Harry Potter universe have a crow? I know Harry had a freaking owl, weird, but it was a cute owl. It was fluffy. It didn't look like a demon or anything, but surely there were crow familiars in the Potterverse.
Yeah, I feel like you can't write a fantasy of that sort and not have a crow or maybe a raven or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ravens are a little spookier. Well, I don't know. It's up for debate.
They're bigger.
That's right. And you see them in California a lot, and they look like almost like little hawks or something, because they're just pitch black and very, very ominous creatures. You guys know where I stand on this. I love this for you, Ben. I'm really glad that you've got some Corvid-related science news to brighten your day. And thanks for sharing.
Oh, yeah, of course, man.
This is great, Ben. I just I want to take it back to that study just quickly. I'm just having a little bit of trouble understanding it fully, and it has nothing to do with the way you explained it. I think it's just the way the articles refer to a lot of the things, because I know there's several things happening. The stimulus occurs to where the crows either see a faint light or not. Then the crow has to decide which of the two buttons it has to hit. What I don't understand is when the rules get changed by, you know, the observers, the scientists, mm-hmm. because it seems like the big thing here is that the rules get changed after the stimulus comes in. Then the crow has to decide which one to hit depending on that new rule. Is that correct?
Yeah, that seems to be about the size of it. The important thing there is that they're exhibiting the ability to adapt their behavior. So they're not learning a rote process. They're not learning something always hit blue, always get treat. What they're learning is sometimes I have to switch the rules up to get the results I want because the communication of these weird human scientists is changing. Is it because they're dicks? I guess so, but they run the treats game, so I'll play ball.
And the big the big thing there is that they're thinking about, they're like jumping thought essentially rather than just A to B. It's
right.
Is that the idea?
They understand more about what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, they don't know, maybe they don't know that there's a science experiment being run on them, but they understand that it's more than just like object, you know, impermanence that children have, you know, where it's like they can actually think bigger. They can think about the framework of the scenario they find themselves in, and in essence, see the experiment for what it is, as opposed to just behaving like a less intelligent creature that would do, like you said, then red light equals treat, and then no light, no whatever. You know what I mean? I don't know. Like,
yeah,
I think
no, it's, yeah, that's a really good explanation. You're on the money there, because I think we should move on this before we end up accidentally making an entire crow podcast. But the big takeaway is that before this month, that would have been considered physically impossible. Crows do not have the equipment that we have laid out in the same way. Crows do not have a cerebral cortex. They have something called a pallium, and that's kind of doing the heavy lifting that a cerebral cortex would do. So yet again, the big thing that makes this important for other studies of non-human intelligence and perhaps that of alien life in the future is that we're learning our brain's setup, our brain's loadout or whatever, is probably just one of many, many options. We don't know what else is out there. But we do know the world luckily still has wild animals. And the problem is, due to COVID, in at least one case, we might have far fewer in the ocean very soon.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And we'll get to that story after a quick sponsor break. And we're back. Okay, so we led with Ben's Corvid story. I keep wanting to say COVID. That's not what that is at all, but it's obviously top of mind for a lot of people. And we have a COVID related story that also involves animals and the idea of scarcity, specifically in the shark community. Now, you guys, I didn't know this at all, but it turns out that there's a substance in sharks' livers called squalene. I'm going to go with squalene, that is used to essentially make vaccines and different medications somehow more effective. I'm not a scientist. I couldn't tell you exactly how that works, but it apparently does. And it's something that is used in medications the world over. But let's think about an event like what we're dealing with as far as COVID is concerned, where if we get a vaccine, it's going to be something millions and millions of people want, or at the very least, we're going to need to make enough doses so everyone can have one if they want it. Right. Like, I know aside from any, you know, COVID truthers or folks that don't believe it's real or folks that are anti-vaccination or what have you, I think it'll probably be hopefully a drop in the bucket, you know, compared to how many people will be running out their door to get that vaccine as soon as they possibly can. And according to a post from a shark advocacy group called Shark Allies, they believe that around 250,000 sharks will need to be slaughtered for that sweet, sweet squalene in their livers. And that is only if each person on the planet wants one dose or needs one dose. There are some potential situations where folks might need two. So in that case, I would double the number to 500,000 sharks for the slaughter in order to make these vaccines. And, you know, this shark advocacy group actually published a petition on change.org where they talk about how using sharks for this COVID-19 vaccination is short-sighted. It's going to cause a big problem balancing out, you know, the ecosystems of the oceans the world over, and it could have unpredictable outcomes. it's something I hadn't really considered. You know, I think of like a vaccine being something entirely generated in a lab without needing any raw materials. It's just science is magic. You just put together some, you know, droppers and make the thing with a little piece of the virus. And that's all you got to do. But obviously, as we know, based on the fact that you can't just make a vaccine for the thing instantly, there's a lot of research and development and trial and error and all of the stuff that goes into it. And apparently sharks are part of the equation.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was reading about squalene because I had never heard of this, to be completely transparent.
Yeah, neither have I.
Yeah. It looks like our human livers produce it too, but we're not quite at the point as a species yet where we say slaughter X amount of people to give Y amount of people a vaccine. It looks like it works by enhancing the immune response. So it kind of ups the octane or the efficacy of a vaccine.
Because you're going to get more, your body is going to respond to it more and you're going to create more, what is it, antibodies? Antibodies? Yeah. Is that the idea?
I think so. Again, I haven't delved deep into the science, but everything that I've read, and this is a very new story, the petition, by the way, has, I think, something in the neighborhood of 15,000 signatures, but it just got posted today, and that today being Monday, September 28th. So this is a relatively new and developing story, at least in terms of the outcry. And this is obviously something people in shark circles would be more intimately familiar with, and their whole issue is that we've never had the quote, they refer to it as supply chain, tested in this way at this scale. And it's something that, you know, on a regular day, maybe there's, you know, some impact to the shark communities, but sharks are also, you know, so many species of them are on the decline, and there's right. obviously a finite number of them in the wild. And this is something that could potentially have, according to this group, have critical effects on sustaining them as a species. You know, this is one of these things too, where if you're talking to the politician or maybe even the scientist, what's a few sharks if it means saving mankind? You know, at the end of the day, if we eliminate all sharks in an effort to save humanity, is that a worthwhile balance? Shark people might say no, or at the very least say figure out a better way. But I don't know. It's an interesting conversation for sure.
Yeah, because there's, from what I understand, sharks are not the only source of this. They're just the cheapest and easiest source. We can get squalene from olive oil or olives rather. And it costs 30% more. And it also takes, I think, like 70 hours to make it as opposed to 10. But, you know, your point, Noel, is the same. It's something we've seen come up in arguments about conservation, where someone says, look, are we going to prevent the progress of mankind into this sensitive marsh environment because of tree frogs? Are we going to say that we're putting tree frogs over the livelihood of human beings? And we'll have other people who say, look, there are almost 8 billion human beings on the planet. There are like a few hundred thousand of, you know, insert species here. It is a difficult argument, but it's also strange because there is an alternative. It's just someone would have to pay more. So I think it's misleading to say it's humans or sharks, you know, other than time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, too. I mean, already apparently 3 million sharks are killed each year for this substance, and they're even hunted for it. Predators that are, you know, deep sea dwellers have more of this compound or this liver oil, I guess, and it's because it helps them float. And as we know about sharks, they have to keep moving. That's obviously important. It's interesting how this you know, certain species adapt to have more of a particular chemical in their bodies, you know, to help make sure they are able to do the things that they are best suited for. I'm literally describing evolution and adaptation, but it always blows my mind when you see it in practice in the real world, in the wild like this.
For sure. I'm just looking about where squalene is being used all over the place, and it looks like, at least according to DuckDuckGo, that there is squalene in all kinds of skin and hair products all over the place. One of the more popular ones I'm looking at, and this is not an ad, is a plant-derived one that is coming up everywhere. I won't name it, but it's the olive oil or other plant-based squalene. And it seems like if we can make that much, where there's that much of a supply of it for all of these products, maybe some of these companies could step up and say, well, hey, if we need extra squalene, we've got a version of it here that may
ship in. Yeah. That's a great idea, Matt.
We'll see if it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to hold my breath. I'm going to keep swimming because if I stop swimming, I will die.
Not going to hold your shark for that one, right?
Yeah.
It's like 3,000 sharks to make 1 ton of this substance. I mean, also the shark population, the maritime population of most animals is, as we alluded to earlier, collapsing. You know what I mean? It's not as if it's going to be easy for these sharks to come back after a cull of something like this, of this magnitude. And, you know, there are people who will say, well, screw sharks. I don't like them. But that's
what a shark ever do for me.
Right. But that's not a valid argument. And sharks already get such a terrible time in the human press because shark attacks are pretty infrequent. Sharks are not usually out to eat you. When they bite people, as a matter of fact, it can be fatal. It's very dangerous. They are just like evolved killing tubes, basically. But what they're doing when they bite people is they're doing a taste test. Right. It's rare for them to bite someone and keep biting. They think we taste gross. They're probably right.
It's that damn Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. You know, if it wasn't for him, sharks would be up there with puppies and kittens. Maybe not, but
I think the problem is when they do, even if it's a taste test, take a little bite, it's terrifying.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a limb.
It's you lose an arm or a hand at the very least.
I always laugh when I've been like, have you guys been close to a shark in the wild?
Nope.
You've definitely seen one in aquariums and stuff, right? They're terrifying. I was in a boat and I was still, you know, I still had the Jaws music playing in the background in my head. I could easily see someone thinking the ocean would be better without them. Although I do think it's short-sighted. I understand the immediacy when you're in the moment, but it makes me wonder how ridiculous it is when you see those survival videos or those how-to insert here, and they're like, oh, you're getting attacked by a shark. Just remember, just pop it on the nose. That's all you need to do.
Just give it a bop. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we think about this too in terms of hunting seasons, right? Like, you know, it's important to maintain the balance of predators and prey. And, you know, black bears, for example, are certain species that aren't allowed to be hunted or what have you. There's usually a reason, because it's about conservation, not only about the species themselves, but about maintaining that balance, you know, in the wild. And I'm sure if sharks didn't need to be around, they would have died out by now. I mean, again, I'm not a scientist, but that seems to be what happens with creatures that don't make an impact in the ecosystem or have some reason for existing.
The oldest living animal right now is a shark. It's a Greenland shark. The poor guy looks the worse for wear, but he was estimated to be around the two oldest were estimated to be around 335 and 392 years old. We are very small in the scheme of things, but if you look at the picture of the Greenland shark, it's just, I don't know the biological sex of this creature, but it's like its front teeth are missing. It's got all these scars. It's not 512 years old, as was falsely reported.
Well, but speaking of like the oldest animals, or, you know, sharks in general have been around since the Carboniferous period, which was around 359 million years ago. And it's actually known as the Golden Age of Sharks because there was an extinction event that killed off a massive amount of underwater species and different lineages of fish. There's a great article in National History Museum's, the UK National History Museum website about this, about the Golden Age of Sharks. And this allowed sharks to flourish and kind of dominate and evolve more quickly, I guess, or it sort of gave rise to a lot of different varieties of sharks because they were able to flourish. So that's a long time for a thing to be around.
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking here. There is a 507-year-old clam apparently called Ming.
Yeah.
It's an invertebrate.
I just wanted to get in front of that. I'm glad you mentioned that, Matt, because we always get letters when we talk about the oldest living thing, no matter how we caveat it. Let's call this the oldest living large vertebrate marine creature. People are going to point out the functionally immortal Hydra, right? Or Turritopsis as well. And then I'm sure we'll get a letter about the quaking aspen and so on.
And the tardigrades.
And the tardigrades.
The tardigrades.
There's so many caveats with this. But thanks for bringing this up, Noel, because I was not aware of the critical role that deep sea sharks, we should say it's specifically deep sea sharks, right? Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of the critical role they played in the world of vaccines and I guess in the world of cosmetics too. I feel like a bad person.
Yeah. And everybody out there who's thinking, hey, you guys want us to get the vaccines for this thing? We know how many rumors and theories are rolling around out there about a potential vaccine. We've been doing reading on it. We've been thinking on it. Just to signal that we're paying attention and we're trying to get the best information we can possibly get before we bring anything to you. But yeah, we're aware.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, you know, especially when you hear stories about the idea of forcing one through or rushing it, you know, mm-hmm. that whole thing really freaks me out. The idea of maybe somehow jettisoning other, you know, FDA type safe. I don't know that they would be able to do that. But what does that mean to you guys when you hear the idea of like certain reports saying, oh, we'll have one by the end of the year. And then other scientists saying like, whoa, 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 no, that's very optimistic.
Always listen to the scientists.
Agree. But at the end of the day, isn't it the government or the administration that if it's like a political boon to try to force something through, wouldn't that be a thing they could potentially make happen? I wonder.
The scary thing for me is when you've got medical professionals on some kind of platform saying things that don't appear to match up with the science that we're researching, that let's say I'm researching, but they are a medical professional and they have a lot of experience in the field. And it's that thing where your brain says, well, I should trust them. They're a doctor and they deal with vaccines all the time, but it's not squaring with what I'm reading from the CDC or the WHO. So then do we trust those organizations? And it just becomes, I'm just trying to signal is that there's a lot of complexity out there and we're trying to wade through a lot of that, as many of you have been signaling to us in your writings to us.
I want to point out for anyone who's looking for something pretty good to watch, it's a great idea. There's a fictional show called Utopia that came out on Amazon recently that deals with without spoiling too much, that deals with a conspiracy to spread something via a desperately needed vaccine. And mm-hmm. I don't know if the producers planned it to publish when it did, but it was good timing, which almost makes up for some of my problems with the writing.
I'm sorry, this is a fiction show. I misheard you. I thought it was a documentary series.
No, terrified right now for a second. Show.
Okay, got it. Well,
but that's a conspiracy theory that's been around forever.
No, yeah.
That somehow a vaccination or the vaccinations are a way to do something terrible to humanity as a whole.
Right.
Right.
And there have been cases where there's pretty compelling evidence that, at least in isolated cases, there was some truth to some of this, you know. Often it must be said via incompetence or pursuing profit over people's lives. But I do want to say, while we're on the subject of vaccines, President Vladimir Putin has said that he's going to take the Sputnik V coronavirus vaccine. He just hasn't said when. So a lot of people would be listening, if they support that government or that regime, they're listening to us and they're like, you guys are being dunderheads. The vaccine is already here. They just won't let us have it.
You think he'll do it like that one guy we talked about who died in a float tank, who like vaccinated himself on a Facebook live stream? Forget the guy's name, but there was like foul play potentially and he had like drugs in the system, but he was all into like these hacks and doing like untested, you know, medications. I can't remember what it was for. It was maybe for herpes. He gave himself like what purported to be a cure for herpes and he did it live on a Facebook stream and then he turned up dead. I wonder if Putin will put his money where his mouth is and get shot up with this magical Russian vaccine so we can all see it.
I would watch it,
but I highly doubt that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough to guess because that's one of the most well protected people alive today. So I would say if it's not just propaganda, and if Putin does in fact take the vaccine, it will be after several other people have taken it and survived. Mm. You know what I mean?
He's clearly fond of Facebook, so we'll see what happens.
I think I just want to reach out across the video screen and the microphone to everybody listening just to say, you know, this is a really scary time, no matter what you believe. And I just got back from a trip where the overall consensus in the small town that I was in appeared to be, at least according to the signs that were on a lot of the small businesses, that coronavirus was a scam, that it was fake, it was a ruse, and we're all being played. And this is a larger number of people living in this small town that I had to visit. And I just wonder how many people out there listening have that viewpoint. And if you do, why? Like, what are you reading that I'm not reading? Or like what feels credible to you that maybe I'm just missing or in my bubble about? I would love to hear from somebody out there who feels that way, that has a good explanation for why they believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said, man. I've been receiving some correspondence from folks. Always grateful to hear from you in this regard. But yeah, I'd also love to hear what you feel has informed your choices in this regard. We did have some episodes that probably still tangentially apply to the current question now. But you know, we're not here to attack people, but we are here to learn from you, which is the most important thing we can do in times like these. But okay, so there we go. End of sharks, maybe end of the species. Crows and owls are in a genocidal war with one another. I don't know about you all, but this feels like a great time for a dose of something a little more optimistic.
No, what are you talking about? It just sounds like a time to escape the whole planet.
All right. Well, six in one hand, I would say. So we'll tell you what we're talking about with a little bit of red-tinged light at the end of the tunnel after a word from our sponsor. Not a crow light. It's a different reference.
And we're back. Yes, that's right. Things may seem like they're going really bad down here on Earth. We've talked about it before. This is the only planet we've got thus far, but we are looking at other potential destinations and other places we can make feel like home, at least. And in that pursuit, in the next few decades, several countries and international organizations are looking to travel to the moon again.
Yeah!
Surprise, surprise. First.
Moon!
There's also some fun controversy about, and I use that word so sarcastically, controversy about China and their desire to build an international space station of their own outside of the International Space Station.
Yeah. It's like the Ghostbusters and the real Ghostbusters are the national championships and the world championships.
It's very much like that, to see who will control space. All of it, apparently, or just near Earth orbit. But again, in the moon, of course, that we mentioned. And then the third one is Mars. That's one of the big destinations.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Once we are going to shoot some people off towards Mars, at least. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it's going to be successful and they'll land. And once they're there, they're going to need to have enough stuff to build things so that they can actually survive there. And you can't take, we've talked about it with Marshall Brain on an episode, you can't just load so much cargo up into a ship that is going to get you to Mars because of, you know, problems with propulsion and all these other things. There's a multitude of reasons here that you need to be able to build things once you get to a destination, and you need to be able to use materials that you either find there or combine materials that you find at your destination with something you've brought, right?
Yes.
So this all comes back to an article in Wired that was put out fairly recently here on the 27th of September, 2020. And it is speaking about, it's the concept of using chitin, which is something we're going to explain in a second, using chitin to build habitats, to create tools, and hopefully some really sick armor for all the people who will be traveling to Mars.
All the Falmer.
Yeah, all the Falmer. Yeah, well, we'll get into that. We'll get into it in a second. So chitin, what is chitin? Before we just do any other learning here, biology-wise, describes chitin as a naturally occurring biopolymer, and it is found in many, many, many creatures on Earth. If you think about a beetle, you've probably seen a beetle before or touched one maybe as a kid or let one crawl on you or maybe yesterday as an adult.
My favorite is Paul.
Oh, Paul. No, okay.
Never mind.
Yeah.
Was,
yeah. Oh, very please. Much. Okay. I don't know how much chitin Paul's got going on, but you know, let us know if you have other information.
You know,
but
Paul, a beetle, Paul, the beetle, Paul McCartney. It was different.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, I get it. But a beetle, no matter how large or small, has an outer shell that is very, very strong compared to the very soft insides of that beetle. Ooh, and that outside is made. I'm sorry.
I just said yum.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole other thing we're going to have to get to with this. But that beetle has that outer shell, right? It's like a carapace that it has around it. That stuff is chitin and a couple other things combined together to create that hardened shell. And the concept here is to use that, mix it with that stuff that's in like a beetle shell and a bunch of other animal shells, with the dirt and other stuff you're going to find on Mars, just the soil. That's not soil. It's just the stony, I don't know, all the chemicals and substances that make up the surface of Mars. Put those things together and you essentially have a brick of some sort that you can use, or a 3D printing substance that you can make a whole little village out of, basically.
That's
to protect yourself. Yeah. I mean, that would be incredible if you could do it.
But Matt, wait a minute. This isn't another sad animal story, is it? This doesn't mean they're going to have to grind up like all the beetles on planet Earth to make space bricks, does it?
No, but kind of in a way on a smaller scale. Oh. By the way, this is all a proposal that was published in PLOS 1. It's titled Martian Biolith, a bio-inspired regolith composite for closed-loop extraterrestrial manufacturing. Whew. And in that peer-reviewed article from PLOS1, they describe essentially a way to have the food source on one of these missions that's going out to, let's say, Mars, be primarily plants that are created there or grown on, you know, when once they land, and as well as they're traveling, and proteins that are based on insects, right? Mm-hmm. So the insects that would be eaten, essentially, or at least would have proteins extracted from them, would have leftover carapaces, which aren't really good for human consumption anyway. They don't do much for you, the chitin that's inside those carapaces. There's some small medical benefits that we can talk about. But really, if you wanted to, you could essentially separate the protein-rich stuff from the insects and the chitin. Mm-hmm. And you take that chitin then, after eating all those delicious insects, and then
which aren't bad,
And I'm not saying they're bad. I'm not
construction.
Yeah, I'm not yucking yums. That's great.
You just got to season them properly. You just got to season them properly.
Just you can fry anything. And the United Nations has wanted people to avoid mass starvation by eating insects on Earth for like a decade. So it's not a crazy idea. And Martians will probably have to do it anyway.
Yeah, they will. And it's a smart thing to do because, again, what you're doing is giving yourself a thing that can create any structures.
A thing.
Within this article, they actually did some experiments where they were able to create tools out of this chitin substance. Mm-hmm. And they used They didn't have any access to Martian, you know, regolith or rocks and things like that, but they were able to use mineral equivalents of what that would be. They combined the chitin with that and they could make like essentially a hatchet, a hammer,
wrench, I think.
A wrench. There are all these things that they conceptualized being able to make, and then they actually made a wrench that they could turn and fix things.
Mm-hmm. Matt, aren't you burying the lead here a little bit? What? Don't they also, wouldn't they be able to use their urine and extract some material in their urea kind of make the bonding agent? Is that the deal?
Yeah. So there are several parts, but some of the main ones are Martian stuff, chitin, and urea from people's pee.
Totally.
So great stuff. And you'd live in the whatever structure you built out of that.
I built this house from my own rusty Martian pee, and I will not be be disrespected by you, kid. This is a parent talking there, Martian kid. You're gonna be a pee constructor like your father and your space father before him.
It makes me think of like the Doozers from Fraggle Rock or something. Or also it makes me think of like, is the moon going to just look like Minecraft? Like, is everything going to be like, you know, geometrically shaped or like made of these bricks? But no.
Matt,
please go on about how you can shape this stuff. That's fascinating to me.
Well, yeah, in the 3D printing stage of this, in the testing that was published in this article, they made these kind of cone shaped structures, or at least models of these cone-shaped structures that they're proposing could be the dwelling places in larger buildings on Mars. Mm-hmm. It looks like maybe something an ant constructed or an insect constructed, just because it looks to be built out of the soil itself or the ground itself, and it just becomes a shape that is hardened, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just looking through this article and seeing all the proposals here, it makes me feel like we humans are going to arrive on Mars and other places if we do these things and create essentially xenomorph hives. Like if you guys remember the Aliens series.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Like essentially taking what exists on that planet, and then this is a completely fictional thing, but they would use their acidic saliva to bond essentially, or to break down substances that existed and then form the hive.
We use our pee.
It's biomimicry.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the height of technology that we're discovering now. And in the applied material science field, a lot of it is us learning to mimic things that other animals have been doing, or natural processes that occurred. Like if you're too good for space urine, I'm going to say it, you don't belong on Mars. Other people want to take the trip. Like what's interesting to me here too, Matt, is one thing I wish the study had talked about a little bit more. I wish they had talked about the Martian elephant in the room, which is that this is a one-way trip for a lot of people. No matter how they describe it, the most feasible way for this kind of exploration to work is for the ships themselves to be dismantled upon landing and become, you know, kind of the bedrock there. So you could keep 3D printing machines, you would keep the life support systems you needed, but then you would ultimately, I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, but you would ultimately end up disassembling a lot of that stuff.
How long does it take to get to Mars?
I think it's like maybe margin of error, two years round trip, because it's a 9 month travel time.
Depending on your speed, obviously.
And then, you know, you're not stopping to pee because you got to save that for Mars. Or actually, they're probably cycling urine during that trip make potable water.
Mm-hmm. Like in Waterworld.
Yeah, I feel like maybe we're focusing too much on the urine part here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But again, like, we would be doing the same thing on the moon. I guess historically we've always had images of moon bases that are so technologically advanced, that are just full of metal and beeping sounds and lights and things like shuttles that go up and down, all these crazy things. What if in reality when we begin creating moon bases and Mars bases and all these other bases, they really do resemble ant hills or ant colonies of some
or
sort.
Beehives, you know? Or,
yeah, with mm-hmm. humans just being in them. How fascinating is that?
Yeah.
But it's because if that is happening and that actually comes to fruition, simultaneously, we will be the creatures that are doing that. We're also the creatures that are edging closer and closer towards the singularity where we're becoming technological beings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we become technological beings or almost fully technological beings, we probably won't need air and all, you know, sustenance and insects for eating anymore. We'd need biofuel of some sort, probably. But sure. that and then also having these strange structures and I don't know, it doesn't seem to square, I guess. So
yeah, like a retro-futuristic neo-primitivism almost, right?
Yeah.
Someone who is not plugged into whatever invisible species-wide net we have would just see a bunch of really spaced out looking folks wandering from human-sized termite mound to human-sized termite mound. But there's something else interesting here, Matt. And I love that you bring up the singularity, because my question would be, all right, so on the, like, just, what is it, the 28th, right, of September? Time mm-hmm. is so weird. Today, before we recorded, Discovery just got reported in Nature Astronomy about the discovery of what appear to be multiple underground liquid water lakes in Mars. So that's a total game changer for us.
Wow.
So we may have also a subterranean species of some sort, because inevitably, you know, these things will begin to speciate. You can only live so far away from Earth before you start to change. And Earthlings will be changing as well as we approach, as you said, a singularity. So I am wondering how long a population on Mars, whatever it becomes, could feasibly say that it's governed by a population on Earth. I think it's a much shorter runway than we believe. You know, if the UN or we're moving away from states and toward corporations, right? So if a corporation is saying, you know, SpaceX is like, okay, this is the SpaceX colony, and then this Martian colony is able to become self-sufficient, then they won't need SpaceX and they won't care about SpaceX. So I would not be surprised. This is speculative. This is conspiratorial. I would not be surprised if the people who are planning these trips are baking in reliance on the Martian side, like the same way that the mercantile or mercantilism based economies would bake in reliance on the colonial side. Like, make no mistake, you don't want these people, whatever they become, to be 100% independent. Because why would they bother with you?
It's a good point, Ben. Something I hadn't considered.
Dude, this is a weird thing to me. I don't know if it's stuff they don't want you to know, but it's definitely just odd to think about our future. And if they don't want you to know it, it could be that, Ben. That
yeah,
SpaceX will make you reliant on them. Or no, not to call you out, SpaceX, you're doing great work, I'm sure. But well, I mean, whatever corporation gets you to Mars may really need you to be on the hook.
That's how somehow. We see it in all the sci-fi, though. That's how it is in the Alien movies. That's how it is in, oh gosh, there was a movie with Robert Pattinson in it recently where there was a space colony.
Lighthouse.
No, not that one. Another real weird one by a French filmmaker, a woman whose name I'm totally forgetting. If Casey Pegram was here, he would know.
Twilight.
It's called High Life. That's what it was called.
I was close.
You were very close. But in this one, like, he's sort of the lone survivor on this thing, and he keeps sending home messages to the home planet or the corporation or whatever. And I don't... Like you couldn't rely on them too much. Would they send shuttles with stuff for you? Or you would have
That's
to grow
the plan.
That would be the plan. Yeah, because the two. So, I mean, why Mars versus the moon? And maybe this has been discussed a bunch, I'm sure, but it's quicker to get to the moon, right? Why not go for moon bases instead of Mars bases if it takes 2 years to get to Mars?
Well, a lot of those lunar places, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of those lunar propositions are meant to be like beachheads. And from there, we expand to Europa, to Mars, and so on. And eventually to, because we had to mention it, eventually to Uranus.
No,
just for a flyby, just
my
a checkup. a routine the moon, checkup.
No, the moon is just a launching pad to Uranus.
Uh-huh.
And, that's and what it's I've already, always been told. It's already crowded, you know? And also, Mars may have the what? Okay, so one salient real argument for Mars over the moon is that Mars may possess resources that are conducive to ultimately self-sustaining human life, or again, Martian life, whatever it becomes.
May, right?
Like, yeah, but at least way more than the lunar surface, sure. At least from our current studies of it.
No water on the moon, bro.
But again, I mean, is it a cost benefit analysis? Like, I mean, you know, even if the moon, you know, you had to make more runs to the moon, it's what, how long does it take to get to the moon? It's only like 3 days, I think.
Yeah. You know, well, part of the argument there is too, that's 3 days if we have the optimal, orbital conditions, right? Like that's why you'll see people saying you could make Mars, you could make the Mars trip in a very short number of months, like as little as 4 or 5, if you go at the right time, which occurs every maybe 2 years, and then you're at the, and then we're still Earthlings, so we're at the mercy of Earth weather, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot less atmosphere to worry about when we're launching from the moon. So once you get there, it's easier to build stuff, maybe, if you have the stuff. I don't know. Also, this is just me guessing, but what if they're brainstorming which rock to land on next? And then someone in marketing comes out and they go, well, you know, the thing about Mars is it's red. It really pops, you know, it looks better on a logo because like we can, and then they're like, all right, somebody run a cost benefit over painting the moon versus going to Mars with a much better color scheme. So maybe it's something like that. We're not in those rooms.
No, we're not. True. God, it would probably be a terrifying place to be. Man, I guess optimistic. Yeah. Space bricks out of insect chitin. More than that. That's oversimplifying, but you can make it into all kinds of shapes. And why can't we use this on Earth to make building materials for, like, you know, developments and stuff like that?
That's why I want to talk to you about this. This is why it's so actually exciting, even though it doesn't sound so appetizing with all the insects and, you know, the slightly strange chitin curiouses and chitin left pauldrons and chitin greaves that we'd be, you know, all
I don't know
wielding.
What any of those words are.
It's fine. The AR is pretty good on some of those. It's a light armor.
Oh, I see.
It's pretty good. You can get like a Tilvani cephalopod helm if you want to. I mean, you could 3D print any of these things out of all that stuff. The chitin throwing stars were particularly interesting. That was an addition that I didn't expect.
Yeah,
like defense on Mars. But I forget where I was going already, guys. Oh, the whole concept here is that if this could be achieved, it would be at least as close as you can get to a closed loop, zero waste solution for building materials on, you know, on another planet. And that would be incredible to use there, right? But you could also take that and translate it to Earth. Like, why not? If we were, as gross as it sounds, if you had a group of people or a large corporation that was manufacturing, let's say, some type of plant and fruit and vegetable, they were all edible, right? And then beside that, and as part of that system, they're also growing flies and a couple other types of insects that grow alongside the fruit and, you know, other food that's being created. And that those two things are being created that feed the humans, right? And then the waste products from liquids as well as from the extra parts of the insects, it's all being used to then fuel all the building materials and all the things that builds the stuff that you need to keep the thing going. And then it just continues cycling through. They've got great diagrams of exactly how that would function on that PLOS-1 article that I mentioned earlier. Yeah. You can actually see how they're proposing it would function.
And I think there's a massive opportunity if this technology becomes viable, which unfortunately means both scalable and affordable. If this technology becomes viable, there's a massive opportunity for relief housing for disaster survivors. Or think about the millions of people who are trapped in refugee camps, sometimes intergenerationally, which essentially function as open air prisons. Those people could have privacy that they haven't had for decades, right? They could also have a little bit more safety than they would have ordinarily from both the elements and from bad actors on the human side. Like, I agree. I think sometimes we, as a species, we get our priorities mixed up. You know what I mean? Like, we're collectively saying, instead of fixing the planet we already have, let's go out to eat on another planet. It's like that. Why don't you stay at home and cook? You've got food. You know what I mean? Clean your kitchen while you're at it. Is a very imperfect comparison to make, but you make such an excellent point here, Matt. My last question for you is, would you live in one of these?
I mean, if I had to, I'd figure out how to make it work. As long as I can get the chitin to display Morrowind, then I'll be fine. Well,
but surely there's things you could add to make it aesthetically pleasing. It doesn't all have to be like gunmetal gray, right? I mean, there's probably some variations you could get to have some patterns and, you know, make something a little more appealing to the eye.
I would just say watch Raised by Wolves. It's available right now on HBO Max.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
that is true. You can also learn more about populations in the modern day who dwell in caves and have for a long time. I think that could inform some of your interior decorating inspirations for your life on Mars or your life here on Earth. So we've gone a little long on this one, but we absolutely hope you enjoy it. You can tell that we are fascinated by all three of these ideas: crows versus owls, sharks versus humans, in a way, and Mars versus the moon versus Earth.
And insects.
And insects, of course, yes. So let us know what you think of these. Let us know what you think of these ideas. Write to us with your personal calculations behind befriending crows or corvids. Write to us with your understanding of sharks versus humans and vaccines in general, your reasons for or against the proposed COVID vaccines or vaccines, just overall. We cannot wait to hear from you, and we try to make it easy to find us.
That's right. You can find us on all the usual internet channels, the social medias, or Conspiracy Stuff Show. You can join our Facebook group. Here's where it gets crazy. Easiest thing in the world. Just go in there, Facebook, search it up, and tell us why you like the show or who any of us are. Name us by name. Or just make Ben laugh. Or just say anything that lets us know that you're aware mainly of what the thing is that you're trying to get into. And then you're in.
That's right. If you don't want to do that, you can give us a phone call. What? Those things can call people? Who knew? Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave us a message. You may end up on one of our listener mail episodes if you do leave a message. So please let us know if you're okay with us playing it on the air, and let us know if we can use your name or if you want any of that stuff to be kept off the record. That's fine with us. Just let us know.
If what you have to say is super juicy and you want us to do one of those cool, kooky voice disguiser things, we might even be able to go the extra mile for that. But it's got to be good. If you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can reach us the old-fashioned way. If you would like, you can send us an email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.